Number one problem in education and leadership is motivation. Overcoming initial inertia. Getting a person off of dead center into action. Much easier to direct a moving object. But resurrection is difficult at any level. I'm more interested in a person's MQ than I am their IQ. Their motivation quotient is much more important to me than their intelligence quotient. Or I think far more important than an individual's ability is his application. Your role as a leader is primarily that of a salesman. You're not selling commodities, but you are selling concepts. Let's take just a moment to define a motive. A motive is primarily that within an individual, not without, which incites him to action. It's primarily that within an individual, not without, which incites him to action. Now, immediately, you discover there are two primary forms of motivation. There is, first of all, what we call extrinsic motivation. That is, that which is external to the individual, any force which impinges upon him from without. But there is another form, and that's intrinsic motivation. That which takes place within the individual. And this is by far the more important one. Not so much what are the forces outside the individual as what are the forces within the individual. And the test of all extrinsic motivation is, does it trigger intrinsic motivation? And there's a lot that never qualifies on this score. You don't get a person into action simply by putting a 45 in his head or by using an organizational club. Or if you are teaching, using a grade book, and I say to the student, you love to do this, don't you? And if he doesn't love it, we flunk him. But you see, when you get out of school, nobody uses a grade book. Nobody rings the bell and tells you it's time to go to class. And I think the most important thing in any individual's life is developing that person to become a self-starter. That is, a person who does what he does or doesn't do certain things. Not because he has to, but because he wants to. Because he chooses to. Now, today, we want to examine some means of motivation. Things that you ought to explore, that ought to become a part of your working capital as a leader, as a mover of individuals. And there are 9 of these that I'd like to share with you. First of all, you motivate an individual by creating a need through personal exposure to reality. Now again, this distinguishes two kinds of needs. There are what we call real needs, most of which exist subsurface. And there is another set of needs which we call felt needs. Felt needs are always needs that exist at the level of consciousness. And your task as a motivator is to take real needs and bring them to the surface so that they become felt needs, so that they become the person's individual property. And you see, many times you could talk about things that are very real needs, but if they're not felt by the individual, you will never motivate them. I tell you, memorize the telephone directory. You say, why? Well, because I tell you to. Yeah, I know, but what will it do for me? Well, it'll give you all of these telephone numbers. You'll have them at immediate access. You say, well, you know, who needs that? I mean, if I need a telephone number, I go to the directory and flip it over and find it. Well, all right, you tell me I ought to memorize them. So you spend all of your time memorizing the telephone directory, and then just about the time you get it all memorized, they change the numbers. Very interesting to see how little Jesus Christ used what I call the storage tank approach to learning. See, forever someone's saying to you, you ought to know this because someday you'll need it. Mark chapter 4, you have a very remarkable series of lectures which our Lord gave to the disciples. And remember, he was the world's greatest teacher. He gave a series of lectures on the essence of faith. And as a good teacher, he gave an examination at the conclusion of the lecture. Not the kind we give. The seminary, we see how much the student can cram in his bean. And then we give him a piece of paper and, you know, he spews it all out. I had to communicate with a student some time ago during examination week. He was sort of walking down the hall, you know, in limbo. And when I came up to him, he said, Prof, don't touch me. I'll leak everything I know. Now, when the Lord gave an examination, he wasn't interested in how many facts the disciples could cram in their heads. He knew that you don't learn faith as a result of a series of lectures. You learn faith in the laboratory of life. So immediately upon finishing the lectures, he said, gentlemen, let's go to the other side of the Lake of Galilee. Roger. Well, out they go. They get into the middle of the lake, and they're in a tremendous storm. Remember, these are professional fishermen. And the Lord is asleep in the ship, and they come and they say, Lord, don't you even care? We're in a process of perishing. The implication is at least you could help to bail out or to row. This is a hopeless case. We're going down. And the Lord arises from his sleep. He rebukes the wind and the wave. No problems there. Then he turns to the disciples and says, how is it that you, that's emphatic in the original text, you of all people have no faith? Oh, why, the man who just heard the lecture. They wrote an examination book, a blue book, and it came back with a great big F on it. And that wasn't for faith. They flunked. See, the Lord said, let's go to the other side, not let's go to the middle of the lake and drown. But that's what they thought was going to happen. It's interesting to study through the life of Christ because it's in reality exposures that they really learn what it meant to trust the Lord. By the way, that's where you learn it. You won't learn very much faith sitting here in these classes, but you'll learn a lot of faith going back to your community, back to your home, back to your campus, back to whatever ministry God has called you to. Student came up at the end of a class one day and he said to me, it was a class in counseling, Professor, do you have something that would stretch me a little bit? I said, you know, I've been down this road. And I said, yeah, I think we could arrange something. So I called up the juvenile department in our city, whom I work as a consultant. And I said, hey, friend, I got a student who needs an education. I said, I got the picture. Send him out. So I sent him out, and they dropped him into the cell of a kid 14 years of age who's billed on 28 major counts of juvenile delinquency. State's just waiting for the kid to grow up to put him away permanently. And when they dropped the student in the cell, the kid's sitting with his feet propped up on a little ledge like that, looking in the opposite direction, and when the student came in, he turned around and said, hey, what's your line? Every day they send somebody in here with a different line. What's yours? You should hear the student tell this. He said, boy, prof, I lost everything I knew right on the floor. But did he ever come back to see if I knew anything about how to handle this kind of a situation? And the reason why most of us feel so confident is that we've never been sufficiently confused. And therefore, one of the things that the Lord does is to put you into a laboratory reality experience to impress you with the fact you really don't know, and you better find out. Secondly, motivate a person by feeding and developing responsibility. Now bear in mind, people thrive on responsibility. And there's a principle underlying this, and it's this. The greater the investment, the greater the interest. The more I put into something, the more I derive from it. Anytime you do anything for a person, which a person is capable of doing for himself, you make him an emotional cripple. And your task is primarily to stretch the faith and the experience of those with whom you work. We have a very remarkable man in our community. He's now retired from his teaching position. He taught for many years with distinction at the Southern Methodist University School of Law. His name is Dr. Sharmus. Nice to send my students out to watch this man in action because he's such a profound motivator. He taught a course in trial law, and he set the course up just like a courtroom scene. He'd have the prosecution on this side, he'd have the defense on this side, he'd have one individual appointed as the judge, and all the rest of the class were in the jury. But everybody was in the end. He'd sit in the back and smoke a cigar. And you think he was out like a light, but he heard absolutely everything that was going on. When they finally finished trying the case, I can still see him yet, storming down the middle of the aisle saying, good night, you're not going to try that case like that, are you? You know what I would do with that prosecution? This is what I do. No prosecution left. Defense is sitting on the sideline saying, boy, did we ever cool this one? And he whips around and says, you know I do with that shoddy defense? This is what I do. Nothing left. The only secure guy is the judge. I can see him wink his eye as he say, hey, man, you want to know how to win that case? Follow me. Like the Pied Piper, he'd take off across the campus and 15, 20 guys would follow him. I used to say to people, if you ever go out to the university and see a man with about 15 or 20 kids following him, that's the man. He'd go over to Lawyers Inn, they'd sit down, have a Coke or a cup of coffee, and say, all right, gentlemen, let me show you how to win that case. This professor has the distinction of having developed more winners in the United States in trial law than any five professors in America. I went out to see him one day. I said, Dr. Sharmitz, I want you to know how much I appreciate you allowing me to send my seminary students out here. Oh, he said, that's all right, Enrich. Delighted to have them. He said, we need some theologues out here occasionally to bail us out. I said, Dr. Sharmus, what's your educational philosophy? He said, educational philosophy? I don't know what in the world you're talking about. He said, I have only one educational principle. I said, what's that? He said, I'd rather have my students lose in here and win out there rather than win in here and lose out there. You know what our problem in evangelical Christianity is? We've got too many winners in here, but they're losing like crazy out there. Our seminary lawyer was trained by Dr. Sharmus. One day I said to him, hey, Bill, what was it like to be in Sharmus's class? He said, Hendricks, after you have had Sharmus, everything in real life is downhill. He said, in all of my years as a lawyer, I've never had anything as threatening as his classes. But this is why he produces winners. Third, you motivate an individual by providing encouragement and recognition. Now, I used to teach homiletics. This is the science of the preparation and delivery of sermons. I taught it for 15 years. What a privilege. I get these kids in the class who had never spoken before once in their life. And I'd give them an assignment. I'd say, all right, men, for the next hour, I want you to come and prepare an illustration. Just one illustration. Illustrate any point you want. I want you to come to class. They'd come to class. I'd say, all right, you, you're on. Oh, me? You. He'd come up here, you know, and he'd grab it. We're going to get up and go out the window. He'd, you know, and he'd start speaking and give his illustration, and all of a sudden he'd stop in the middle of it and say, good night. I forgot the point of the illustration. He said, let me sit down. I said, no, you can't. Anybody here want him to sit down? Nobody wants him down. Oh, yeah. He said, I got it. And he'd give the rest of the illustration. And he'd sit down and he'd break out a little smile. And I'd say, hey, man, is that the first time you've ever spoken to a group this size? He said, that's right, bro. First time. Whole place would explode. Load with applause. Man, that's fantastic. You see, here I am in the process of learning how to speak. You know how you learn to speak? By speaking. See, I've never yet heard of a correspondence course in swimming. Have you? But you don't learn to swim by reading books about swimming, or even by watching the pros go up and down in the pool. You learn to swim by swimming. You've got to become involved in the process. But what you really need is someone who can encourage you and say, hey, that's great, man, you're starting. But, you know, I can almost hear it now. Some of us are going to go back, and we're going to have a training session. Four laws. All right, there's been no explosions. We're going to show you how to do it. So we explain the process, and then we say, all right, now we're going to have some practice sessions. So you, how about you coming up and try it? All right. You know, and they come up. We sit on the sideline. They go through. They got the fourth on the first place and the third law in the second. And they finally made up a new law. You know, and I can almost see you on the side. So, no. You know, how long have I been with you? You're writing your little critique card and turning the thing over and, well, okay, thanks a lot. We got to start somewhere. Now, let me tell you what's wrong with that thing. I got 27 things on this card that's wrong with this thing. And that really motivates him. You know, I could hardly wait for another opportunity to share the four laws. Right? No. And furthermore, that's not what he needs. I can bring a moron off the street that can hear you present the four laws and he'll tell you what's wrong with it. What you really need to know is, what do you got going for you? What's right about it? What is it that develops your confidence? And that's why it takes a lot of encouragement. But there's a key here, young people, and it's this. You've got to know what to get excited about. and most of us don't. We're excited about the wrong things. We're excited about what we can do rather than about what other people can do. I used to teach a class for professional men, and I had a course in how to study the Bible for yourself. I led this neurosurgeon to Christ, and he came into the course, and like the rest of these men, they got so turned on because they get them into the Word, and they discovered these fantastic things for themselves. They were like kids with new toys, never had enough time to share the results of what we found. So after the class, you know, this doctor would come up and he'd say, "Hey, Hendricks, let me show you what I found in that passage." I'd say, "Really, what did you find?" You know what he'd tell me? He'd share what he found. And what he was really saying to me was, "I'll bet Luther never saw that truth. I'll bet Calvin never heard of that." What he's saying, though he never verbalizes it, is, "And I'll bet you haven't seen it either, Hendricks." And you know, I wouldn't tell him I had. But what most of us would say is, "Well, yeah, Doc, that's pretty good." In fact, I remember 32 years ago when I came to know Jesus, I saw that truth. And that really turns him on, doesn't it? My friend, you never saw a seminary professor get as excited as I do. I froth at the mouth and fairly need to be led away. I say to him, "Do you mean to tell me you saw that, Doc?" He said, "Man, that's right, and that's not all I've seen. Sit down. I'll show you some more." So this doctor's wife on the parking lot at the church one day, she said, "What in the world are you doing to my husband?" I said, "Why? What's the matter with us?" She said, "This guy is so involved in studying scriptures, I've got to set an alarm clock to tell this guy what time to go to bed at night." Which is a slightly different wrinkle. It comes only when you, who have the confidence of the individual, communicate that confidence to them. You can do it. That's a great start. Fourth, you motivate an individual by showing him how. You know, one of the greatest things that ever hit the Christian scene is this little booklet, Four Spiritual Laws. You know why that's a profound instrument, an effective tool? I'll tell you very simply. It puts in a structured form, in a packaged way, something that the average person can get a hold of and understand and use. This is why our churches are failing. We are long on exhortation, we are short on explanation. As one layman put it, we're always telling people what they ought to do, but we're not telling them how to do it. Let me give you an illustration. One of the most prominent surgeons in our community is an ophthalmologist, an eye surgeon, Dr. Jack Cooper by name. Dr. Jack was a Christian for many years. He was deeply involved in the local church. In fact, he was a part of the power structure of the group of crusade kids came along one day and said to him, "Hey, Doc, are you sharing your faith?" He said, "No, as a matter of fact, I'm not." They said, "How come?" He said, "Well, to be perfectly honest with you, I don't know how." They said, "Well, we got a lay training institute coming into town that can teach you how." He said, "Count me in." So they enrolled him in the program, taught him how to use little four-law booklet, took him out to the air. He saw people trust Christ right in front of his eyes. Until finally he says, "Hey, let me try that." And the first person he presented the gospel to was a soldier who was waiting in the air terminal to catch another plane. And the man trusted Christ. That's all he needed. And then he began to think, you know, how can I use this in my profession? Well, you know, you go to a doctor's office, you spend the bulk of your time waiting, so you look around for something to do, and you read all the garbage that's around. Finally, you run out of gas. So he put these little booklets around. People pick these up and think, "Hey, you heard of the Four Spiritual Laws?" "No, don't think I have."
start through the thing. Pretty soon they come into his office and say, "Hey, doctor, that's a fascinating booklet you got out there." He said, "You understand it?" "Well," he said, "very interesting." He said, "Well, let me explain it to you." And the first thing you know, he was leading people to Christ in his office. Until finally it dawned on him, you know, there must be a better way of doing this. Now, you've all been to a eye doctor, and you know he's got a chart up on the wall. You know, when I go, they usually say, "Hey, read that chart." You know, up on what chart? You know, up on the wall. What wall? So he puts the four laws up on the eye chart. And my friends, this medical doctor has led more people than I know or any professional. In fact, I was way out in the remotest section of India conducting a training conference, and I used this illustration without using the man's name, figuring, you know, who in the world would know Dr. Jack Cooper out here? And when I got through, an Indian came up and said, "Hey, you were talking about Dr. Jack Cooper, weren't you?" I said, "Yeah, man, how did you know?" He said, "I attended university in Dallas, and while I was there, my eyes went out." I said, "I got the picture." He said, "Dr. Cooper led me to Christ, and he met with me twice every week for an hour and a half a day to get me into the Word of God and to disciple me." And here's a man, the only man in the country of India who is professionally certified in his field, out there bearing a faithful witness for Jesus Christ because a doctor in Dallas had somebody teach him how to share his faith. And that's what you ought to be doing when you go back. Fifth, you motivate by personal enthusiasm. I don't know about you, but I appreciate a speaker who is at least sold on what he's talking about. I may not even agree with him, but at least he's convinced you ought to listen. You can't get out of here without understanding what I'm talking about. But you know, many times I'm compelled to listen to sermons, and boy, that's a bad scene. You know, I go to church and I sit there and, you know, pretty soon I'm under the table. And, you know, I have the strongest urge to stop him. I'm still waiting to build up enough courage for this. But one of these days I'm going to say, "Hey, hold it." Wouldn't that jar the audience? Might even get somebody awake in the service. So hold it, man. I don't think you believe that. "Oh, yeah, I do." "No, you couldn't." "Yeah, I really do. It's very..." "No, you don't." "You couldn't be." "Yeah, I do. You better believe it. Well, tell me about it." But, you know, here they are saying, "Boy, it's wonderful to know Jesus." And the Christian life is so exciting. I think, really, one of the great needs in communication is for a passion to communicate. You show me a person who has a passion to communicate, and I will show you a person who will pay any price tag to get the message across. But bear in mind, young people, if you want someone else to bleed, you're going to have to hemorrhage. And you better start getting excited over the only things that are really worthwhile getting excited about. Six, you can motivate an individual by intensifying interpersonal relationships. The closer you get to a person, the greater the potential of motivation. But it's hard to motivate a person across a chasm. And I'm way over here on this cliff, and they're way over there on that cliff, and they're 4 miles between us. And I'm trying to shout and wave my hands, telling them what to do. No, you better build a bridge across the chasm and go over and sit down next to them. My students ask profound questions. They ask questions like, what time is this period over? Boy, that really gets to you. They ask questions like, Dr. Hendricks, are you going to ask this on the examination? That's a question in depth. And while they're filing out the doors, I'll say to them, hey, how about coming out to my house tonight? Sure, Prof, what are you planning to do? I don't know. Come on out, we'll find out. 15, 20, 30 of them come out to our house. Pretty soon we get a Coke in our hands and we're embroiled in the discussion sitting on the floor. And before you know it, it's 2:30 in the morning. And nobody's saying, hey, when's this period over? You going to ask this on the exam? Young people, I don't understand all I know. But there's one thing I've learned, and that is that the average four walls of a classroom are conducive not to learn. The average person comes and says, I'm now going to proceed to be learned. Learn me, I dare you. And I get them in the snack shack, and I take them with me when I go out on trips, and I hope wherever you go, you always take somebody with you. And I have them over to my home, or I drop over to their apartment, throw myself across the bed and say, hey man, tell me what's happening. And it's in these informal sessions where you really begin to make an impact upon individuals. A number of years ago, I went to the Philippines for ministry. And the people in my church are very gracious people. They said, Hendricks, you're going to the Philippines. Please take some pictures. Their motto is, go ye into all the world and take pictures. So I went to the Philippines and I took some pictures and I came back. They said, you have been to the Philippines. Please show us your pictures. I showed them my pictures. They said, your pictures are very fine. Thank you very much. And on the way home, I said to my wife, what a waste of time and money. I said, from now on, we move into Plan B. Every Sunday night, we're going to take a little segment of people and we're going to invite them over to our home, sweetheart. And we just happen to have some pictures. So one night, I invited three medical doctors over. I said, hey, man, I got something you guys would really like to see. I've been up in Ifugao territory, and I took some pictures of a clinic up there that a doctor established, and I think you'd be interested in it. And I have some tremendous shots of the pharmacy with the empty shelves. He said, what's that? He said, that's the pharmacy. Pharmacy. Where are the pharmaceuticals? I don't know. They don't have any over there. Next picture. Oh, wait a minute. How can you have a pharmacy without pharmaceuticals? I don't know. They got one over there. Go all the way through the pictures, and by the time we get to the end, you know what the first question is? Hey, how can you have a pharmacy without pharmaceuticals? These three doctors have been instrumental in sending scores of shipments of drugs to that great clinic. Almost $35,000 worth of drugs. You know how? By personal involvement. And I would say to you very emphatically, I do not believe there is anyone who cannot be motivated, but not in the same way and not necessarily by the same person. See, I hope you are aware of the fact that you are not God's gift to everyone. And if you can't believe that, take it by faith. That's why we have a body, because everybody is needed. 7. You motivate by dissolving emotional blocks. See, a person who is angry, a person who is embarrassed, a person who is resentful, a person who is fearful is a very poor prospect for learning. So one of your tasks is to dissolve these emotional blocks. And that's why what you are to the person is far more important than what you say to the person, or even what you do. Because what you are to the person will probably determine what they hear you say and what they do as a result of what they hear. Now, this calls for a climate, for an atmosphere of acceptance. In our community, we have a lot of home Bible classes. These have been very, very successful in leading people to Jesus Christ. And we've learned a lot of things about running Bible classes. In fact, I think we have made every possible mistake. One of the things that we've discovered is that the most important thing in that class is the climate. It's whether you establish an atmosphere of acceptance where a person can ask any question they want without fear of ridicule. Let me give you an illustration. By the way, this is a hard thing to produce in training. We have a principle that if we can get you into an argument, you can never teach one of our home Bible classes. And we have become masters at getting you into an argument. That's our way of finding whether you're prepared to teach these classes. For example, right in the middle of a class, one guy stopped and said, "Hey, hold it. You don't mean to tell me that you're saying that Jesus Christ is God, are you?" Now, how would you handle that situation? Can you imagine what would happen in the average church if somebody said, "You don't mean to tell me you're saying that Jesus Christ is God, are you?" "We wouldn't. How in the world is that?" Now, all you have to do is to ream that person out, to scorch him. And that's the last question he will ask. "You know, we don't ask questions like that in here." "Any other question?" So you know what we do? We make a hero out of the person that asks this question. We say, "Hey, man, Jim, that's fantastic. Here's a guy really coming to grips with the issues." And the interesting thing we've discovered with research is that he never hears the answer that you give. What he does get is the message you convey as to whether you are welcome to ask questions like that. And you motivate a person by demonstrating unconditional love. Beautiful to see this in operation in the life of Jesus Christ. His total acceptance of the disciples. You ever think of all of the inane things these people said in the presence of the personification of truth? See, I would have thought that Jesus Christ, who was the truth, would have said, "Look, gentlemen, I'm only going to be here for 3.5 years, so take all this stuff down. You only got a one-shot opportunity." But he didn't. He said, "I got a lot of things to tell you, but you're not able to bear them now, but that's no problem to me, because when he, the Spirit of truth, has come, he'll guide you into all truth." See, there was no compulsiveness on Christ's part to teach people everything he knew right now. By the way, it's a great curse of going back from a seminar like this. And that your urge is to teach him everything that you learned today. Now, this is going to take some time. This is going to take some love. Jesus Christ never upbraided the disciples for their mistakes. The only thing he ever rebuked them for was their lack of faith. And isn't it interesting? After the biggest bust in all of their life at the cross, the first time he met him, you know what he told them? "Men, now let's If my disciples had failed as the disciples of Jesus Christ did, I'd have gotten them together and said, "All right, men, now the first thing we're going to have to do is to understand a few basic principles. You're not going to be able to blow it like that, or we're never going to make it." Jesus Christ didn't. First time he met them, imagine, after they had disappointed him so tragically, when they get together, he says, "All right, men, now, let's go take the world." That's a ministry of affirmation. A ministry of confidence. And that's why he said to Peter on three occasions, "Peter, do you love me?" See, that's the real issue. Because love produces loyalty. Ninth and last, you motivate a person by believing that God can make them a significant person. Now hear me. How you see a person will very largely determine what that person becomes. So if you see them as a problem, you'll have the dubious distinction of developing them into one. If you see them as potential, there's no limit to what they may become. Student came up after class one day, said, "Prof, I've got a real problem." "Really? What's that?" He said, "Why did Christ choose Judas?" "Oh," he said, "that's no problem." "You don't think so?" "Uh-uh. They got scriptural reasons for that." "So I got a bigger problem than that." "Really? What's that?" "Why he chose you." While he was still recovering from that, I said, "Man, I got a bigger problem than that." And that's how I got in. See, I got more scriptural reason for why Christ chose Judas than why he chose you, than why he chose me. That's the miracle of the ministry, that God handpicked you and me to be his representatives to this generation. And my friends, God could have used far greater means than us. I hope you never recover from the fact that he handpicked you. And he demonstrated his confidence in the Spirit's ability to work in you. You know, it's very interesting because I can only remember two school teachers in all of my life. I remember my fifth grade teacher and my sixth grade teacher. My fifth grade teacher was Miss Simon. I'll never forget her, and I'm convinced she will never forget me. Boy, I gave that woman unholy grief. I really tore that class apart. Until finally she got so exasperated, she decided to tie me to my seat with a rope. She took my hands and tied them behind my back like this, tied me to the seat, took mucilage paper and started around this side and went all the way around the other side over my mouth, and she'd say, "Now, Howard, you will sit still and keep quiet." "So what else do you do?" Well, finally, I was graduated from her class for obvious reasons. And I went into my sixth grade teacher, Miss Noe. Miss Noe was 6 feet 4 inches tall. And I used to think, if that dear woman had done nothing but just stand erect, she would have done something for you. And I introduced myself. I said, "I'm Howard Hendricks." She said, "Oh, I've heard a lot about you." And I thought, here we go again. And then she jarred me by saying, "But I don't believe a word of it." My friends, I met the first person in all of my life. First class, I'd knock myself out in special projects. I'd run errands for her. I'd stay after class. I can remember working so hard at the desk and occasionally looking over at the door, and there was a little window in the door, and there framed in the window was Miss Simon, my fifth grade teacher, who had just come to see this thing which was come to pass. There he is, sitting clothed and in his right mind. You know, I've often thought, I wonder how many people there are who are lost to the cause of Christ because there are so few of us that can see beyond the superficial to see what God can do in the heart. I come from a wonderful church in the Philadelphia area, some fine people there. And they recently celebrated their 40th anniversary and invited me to come back to speak at the banquet. After I got through speaking, some of these dear people came up and said, "Oh, Howard, we're so proud of you." And I didn't say this, you understand, I'm a very gracious individual. But I had the strongest urge to say, "Really, lady, you didn't help at all." Because I can count on that hand the number of people in that evangelical church who ever saw me as anything other than the brat from 7th Street. They used to tell me. And there were just a couple people in that church who somehow, by the ministry of the Spirit of God, could see beyond that superficial exterior, that temporary facade, to see that God was going to do something in my life, and who believed Him for that. And I am convinced that I'm in the ministry today very largely as a group of just a small core of people who believed that God could perform an impossible thing in my life. Motivation, my friends, always makes the difference. I'm sure you are asking, what's going to be the impact of Expo 74? I was asked this just yesterday afternoon. I'll tell you the answer. The impact of Expo 74 will not be determined primarily by what happens here. It will be determined by what you do as a result of what happened here. And if you go back and you're pretty much the same as when you came, then my friend, we wasted one pile of money. We wasted an awful lot of time. We greatly grieved the heart of Jesus Christ. This was the biggest fraud of this generation. But if you go back a different person, then there's no limit to what God can accomplish. See, when you go back, things will be pretty much the same as when you left. Nothing will have changed there. The real question is, will you have changed? And if you have changed, then you may make a great change on the sphere of influence in which God places you.